Good afternoon, bon après-midi. C'est un immense plaisir pour moi d'accueillir David Spiegel, que j'ai le privilège de connaître depuis quelques années déjà. Je dois admettre bien candidement que je suis un grand fan de David Spiegel. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a influencé dans ma carrière et dont j'estime beaucoup les travaux. C'est quelqu'un aussi qui a, à mon sens, une culture en psychologie dont la vastitude m'impressionne beaucoup. Je suis donc vraiment très heureux que ce soit David Spiegel qui ouvre cet après-midi le volet de l'OTAN pour l'atelier de recherche avancée. C'est vraiment un grand privilège pour moi. I'm really honored to present you David Spiegel today, who will be opening the NATO Advanced Research Workshop. And I'm particularly pleased because I've known Dr. Spiegel for a few years now. It's a colleague that I have in high esteem. I'm particularly impressed by his culture, his psychological culture, the breadth of his culture. He has worked in the area of trauma, dissociation, cancer. He has a strong background in psychoanalysis and psychology. He's able to talk about almost anything. And on top of that, he's able to talk about it either in French or in English, which is another reason why we like to invite him. And on top of that, he teaches behind one of the greatest wineries in California. Lucky guy. You wouldn't find that here. So really, I don't want to introduce him more formally than that, because really what I want to say is that I think he's an amazing researcher and speaker. Here's David Spiegel.
Je vous remercie beaucoup, Alain, et aussi pour avoir fait l'arrangement pour ce congrès. C'était très intéressant et merci beaucoup pour cela. Ça m'est un grand plaisir d'être ici au Canada. Vous avez entendu que la définition d'un Canadien, c'est un Américain sans fusil et avec assurance de santé. C'est la différence. Je crois que pour la plupart, vous pouvez m'entendre en anglais, mais s'il y a des questions, je peux parler avec vous, même en anglais, en français. Le chef de l'Académie française avait dit, de parler l'anglais, c'est une nécessité, de parler français, c'est un privilège. Oui, voilà. Okay, so I will convert to my mother tongue. And would like to share experience. We've had both the benefits and the problems in doing internet research, and what I think are the still as yet largely untapped opportunities for using the internet to study trauma and traumatic response. I'm supposed to commence with consulting disclosures, and my one consulting arrangement is with actually Nissan, so it's not the virtual highway, it's the real highway. I don't think it will unduly influence what I have to say, with the possible exception of what you'll see on the next slide here. This is, I think, a freeway in Southern California, and we needed it after Arnold Schwarzenegger became the governor. He's the only governor in American state that cannot pronounce the name of his own state, California. So what I would like to discuss with you, and I would be glad, I'll try and leave some time at the end for questions, but if there are specific questions or things that aren't clear during the lecture, please feel free to ask. Four issues: the internet as a resource, lessons that we've learned in particular from our research on 9/11, principles of the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, and how that applies to ways in which we may be able to use the internet in trauma research and implications for the future. First of all, some of this has been presented before, so I will go through it quickly, but the Pew Foundation has done some very interesting surveys of internet use, and what they've shown is that about 3/4 of American adults use the internet. As you might expect, the youngest age group use it twice as much as the oldest age group, but as we age and get smarter, we use it more as we get older, and of course, demographically, pretty soon, everybody will be using the internet. This was done a few months ago, so I'm not sure there's anybody left in the United States with income over $75,000, but if there is, and they haven't given it to Bernie Madoff to dispose of, 94% of them use the internet compared with 57% of people under 30,000. And that's actually quite striking, that people who are really quite poor still have a substantial a majority of them still have access to the internet. So in terms of spreading the opportunity for sharing information and dealing with traumatic events, that's an encouraging sign that you don't have to have a lot of money to have access to the internet. There are not big ethnic differences. About 2/3 of African Americans and Hispanics are on the internet. There are some location differences. The internet use is higher in urban and suburban areas than it is in rural areas. And that's, I think, a real challenge. Now, some of it has to do, of course, with just wiring problems, although I think those few remaining challenges will get fixed fairly quickly. But the opportunities for using the internet to access people who are physically remote, to provide emotional support, provide information, is actually, I think, more important in rural areas than it is in urban areas. So I think getting the nation wired is, and particularly in rural areas, is very important. As you might expect, education has a lot to do with it. So almost everybody with a college degree is on the internet, only 1/3 of people without a high school degree, another reason why we need to focus more on education. And by the way, you know, sharing in everybody's delight with the change of regime in Washington, I was particularly delighted when President Obama made his first visit to Ottawa. His first outside foreign visit was to Canada. And all the banners that said, "Yes, we Canada," around Ottawa, which I thought was terrific. 3/4 of people use the internet now for health information. Now, that's really quite striking, because there are a lot of things people go on the internet for. I think the only thing that is probably higher than that is pornography. Shopping, 71%, news, 70%, banking, about half, sports, 45%, mental health, 22%. So people selectively think of the internet as a source for information on health, and I think that tells you, A, how useful the internet is, and B, how badly we educate people about health. That is, our traditional ways of teaching them aren't working, and so they're using this sprawling new mechanism with a lot of good and a lot of really terrible information on it to help people get informed about health. And one other thing that I will come back to is what we call the helper therapy principle, that you feel better about yourself to the extent that you can use your information to turn around and help others. 55% in the Pew survey said they felt eager to share their new health or medical knowledge with others. An e-patient wrote, "Knowing that you are doing what you can to help others who have come down the path after you and who are as bewildered as you were when you were on the path." I see my son do this all the time, you know, when something isn't working. He'll just Google a little phrase and get, you know, 10 blogs from people who had the same problem and figured out how to deal with it. People turn around and answer. That's a very powerful tool. There are people who are in the same spot that you are, and they solidify their own competence by turning around and helping someone else. Now, that's a well-guarded secret in medicine. You know, the rule when I was at Boston City Hospital training, learning to do lumbar punctures and IVs and things, was see one, screw one, do one, teach one. You know, so the minute you finally figured out how to do it, you would turn around and teach the next hapless medical student who came along. And that was, you know, moderately decent teaching, because I knew what the problems were in learning how to do it. But it also helped to solidify my own sense as a physician that I knew what I was doing. And that can apply to patients as well as to doctors. There's no reason why that same sense of accumulating competence by passing on information can't apply to people who are dealing with these traumatic events. And that's where the internet is a fantastic resource that we have barely begun to tap. So thinking about the internet as a, now putting aside the issue of providing emotional support for a moment and just thinking about the issue of how can we use the internet to help with sampling, there are a number of tremendous opportunities in the internet. There's broad population access. much superior to convenience sampling and even telephone surveys. And we had a discussion at the workshop yesterday. I think the internet is changing the game in terms of research, because previously we had two rather different research strategies. One was what is disparagingly called convenience sampling. Believe me, from doing 30 years of clinical research, I can tell you getting those samples is not convenient. It's hard. It's hard work. But there are people who are nearby and will enroll in your studies. They tend to be relatively small samples, you know, from 25, 50, 100, couple hundred. There are multi-center studies that may have thousands, and that was sort of at one extreme. It was hard to generalize from those populations to much broader populations. So the other extreme were epidemiological surveys. So there you would ask one really bad question to 40,000 people and, you know, decide that you had an answer. And it's really interesting how you could never get away in a convenience sample study with the kinds of questionnaires that are used in these epi studies, right? Because we have to worry about alpha coefficients and how reliable and valid the questionnaires are and give people 25 questions to answer anything. And there, one or two questions for 40,000 people is fine. So there are already these kind of disparities between the two kinds of research. The internet allows you to access samples that are of the size of epidemiological studies, but ask them if they're willing to sit and fill out your questionnaires. Much more elaborate data. And it changes the game, I think, in terms of sampling. Now, it is still the case that if you want to make a claim about having a representative sample of the population, you have to engage in some systematic sampling strategy. But I'm also here to tell you that many of the ones that have been used are pretty bad. And the classic, of course, is random digit dialing on telephones. And the obvious thing, first of all, is particularly these days, you get a very skewed sample if you do that, because the majority of young people don't have landlines. And only recently have they been able to get cell phone numbers to do random digit dialing with cell phones. And even then, a lot of times these people don't answer their phone from strangers. So any sampling strategy has its biases. And what I'm hoping we will do is think broadly about the opportunities the internet provides, because I think it will allow us to do a lot of surveys that are somewhere in between the old convenience sampling surveys and the old epi surveys that can correct for some biases simply because the sample is so large that it makes it less likely that random error in a small sample is going to very much bias what the results are. And you can also use demographic variables to control for what you learn. So I think there are new opportunities in thinking about how we do trauma-related surveys. Some of the strategies you can use are propensity weighting. You can adjust for differences in the older phone versus internet surveys. You can use individual verification technology. You know, obviously, people can fake their responses. They can do it in person. They can do it online. You worry about people, you know, some guy setting up a program to respond 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 times to the same survey. There are ways of dealing with that. It can be a problem. You can have people have to enter an ID or a password, or you can use those things where they have to read a sort of strange-looking letter and enter it so that an automatic spam system can't keep responding over and over again. Or you can model their responses in ways that allow you to see whether you're getting unique response patterns or not. So there are ways of dealing with the relatively greater anonymity and possibility for false information coming in on the internet. It's a problem, but I personally think it's a soluble problem. In terms of providing information, rather than just emotional support, I think there are a number of other opportunities we can think about in dealing with trauma on the internet. The range of information is immense, from breaking news that we're now getting much faster on the internet than we certainly do in print media and even on television media, to archives of everything that's been written, like Google Books, where you can search, you know, the whole Stanford Library is now being scanned, and a number of other university libraries on Google Books, and you can get quotes on a page before and after, as well as that page, of virtually any book now. So the opportunity for scanning information is incredible. The real question then is, what is the quality of the information, and how do you organize it? As Google has figured out, organizing the information is in many ways more important than the information itself, because it can be great information, but if you don't find it, it doesn't exist. And so, given the wealth of information, I think the way in which we can think about how to organize, make it available. And two examples that I think are very important are, you know, focus searches, and Google is very good at helping you put search terms together and come up with information that is more specifically salient. Another thing that I've been encouraging, for example, the NCI and their cancer patient information a website to do, is do what Amazon.com does. You know, Amazon remembers every search or purchase you've made on the site, and so it starts making suggestions to you. It starts directing your subsequent searches toward the kind of books or other things that you had ordered. And so that means the system is learning about you as you're learning from the system. Now, that can be misused. It can limit what you learn, but it can also help you a lot. It can help you get to quickly to the focus of the kind of information you want or need. And I think there are tremendous opportunities, particularly in the pressured time after acute trauma, when having search possibilities that can direct, based on certain simple demographic or other characteristics, the nature of your search for information can be extremely powerful and helpful. So what I'd like to do is tell you a bit about our experience in studying the 9/11 attacks, and then some lessons that we've learned from it, both in terms of the content of what we found and also the process of how to conduct such surveys. We were as shaken as everyone else, and I'm here to tell you that the trauma of this kind of thing extends easily. My father watched this happen from the window of his apartment at 87th and Park, and he's a decorated World War II veteran. He was quite shaken by it. I was fortunately able to get to him on the phone before the phone lines were down. But on the other side of the continent, there were three car accidents in the parking lot outside of our building that day. And it's not a very complicated parking lot, and I can't remember another time when there was one accident in the parking lot. So people get very disorganized and have problems processing information at the time these things happen. We sat down and started thinking about what we could do to help understand and maybe help people deal with the aftermath of 9/11. So we put up a website here, coping.stanford.edu. We quickly put together some surveys. There were standard questionnaires on trauma exposure, demographics, symptoms of acute stress disorder, how they were managing their emotions, coping, social support, and cognitive reorientation. And we've been, over time, publishing this in a number of journals. A major report is coming out in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. It has been a very slow process because the data analysis is extremely complicated. Some of our early work has been published in CNS Spectrums as well, and there's another report that I'll mention later. So we managed to get this through our IRB. It helped only a little bit that I'm a chair of one of the IRB panels, and obviously didn't go to my IRB, but the big problems and the big things to think about in doing this are, of course, you know, consent will be different. You're not going to have a signed consent form, but there are consent opportunities you can place and have them respond to. The other thing is server security, is that you have to be sure that you can guarantee the security of the information, and that means systems that are not just routine server systems but have levels of security built into them so that they can't easily be raided by somebody outside the system, for example. So we managed in a couple of weeks to convince the IRB that we had adequate security. We had to do a trade-off, and one other thing to think about is how much individual identification do you want? If you don't want any individual identification, so you could never trace the input back to its origin, the IRBs tend to be a little easier on what you're allowed to do and ask. If you want to do any follow-up, though, you have to have individual ID, which we did. So our trade-off at the time was, we'll ask for 1 6-month follow-up, and that's it. So unfortunately, we can't do farther, longer follow-up because we wanted to get this up and running quickly, and they were willing to agree to let us go that far, and that's what we did. So our objectives were to document responses Americans and others had to the terrorist attacks, how they managed, factors that helped or hindered their recovery, and resiliency and possibly even growth in response to these experiences. So we posted this. We kind of got web word of mouth out as well as using traditional media. And to our surprise, we got 7,582 people to sit down and fill out our baseline questionnaires. And these were fairly extensive, so it would take you at least an hour to sit there on the web and fill out our questionnaires. And it was a much larger response than we had expected to get. The first follow-up was a brief follow-up, and we got less than half. We got almost 4,000 6-month follow-ups, so that's a pretty good-sized sample. Now, this is not a population sample. We didn't do population sampling. We invited people to respond. So the data I give you are not meant and do not represent the sort of standard population response, but rather we're focusing on follow-up, on what can you learn about somebody at baseline that will predict how they will respond later on. And for that kind of question, for a prediction of subsequent outcome, you don't have to have a standard population sample. You can, it's more like a very large convenient sample study trying to predict subsequent behavior from baseline information, and that's what we got. Oops, sorry. We got data from 39 countries, all 50 U.S. states. 93% of the sample were U.S. citizens, 17% were from ground zero states or states contiguous to them. We actually had several hundred people who were very proximate, five who were in one of the World Trade Center buildings, 14 rescuers, four who were on the phone with the victim in the building, 82 who watched it in person, 42 were in the vicinity, 69 heard or felt it, and one was a, and 107 were on the phone with a witness. So a number of them had very proximate exposure to the traumatic events. The main analysis that I'm going to talk with you about today is one in which we selected a random sample of 1,281 who were U.S. citizens, were not among the several hundred who were very proximately exposed, and who provided us with follow-up data. There were two basic measures of how well they were doing. One was the brief symptom inventory, and the other was the psychological well-being scale that Carol Riff developed. And you can see here that our sample was moderately distressed, that at baseline, the mean non-patient score for the brief symptom inventory is 0.3, it was 0.55, and psychiatric patients score around 1.3. So this was not extremely distressed, but was a moderately distressed sample on this measure. The way we analyzed the data, and in all the results I'll present to you, we used regression in which the baseline score was controlled in determining six-month outcome. As you would understand, the same measure will obviously correlate reasonably highly with itself at follow-up. And so what we did was partial out the variance that is accounted for by the relationship at baseline of that measure to that measure at follow-up. So we're talking about prediction above and beyond any relationships at baseline. So what were some of the things that seemed to predict better and worse outcome after 9/11? One of them, as you would certainly hope, was education. So the college tuition that you pay for your kids in the U.S. Is worth it. People who were well-educated were less distressed at baseline and had better well-being at six-month follow-up. Now, media exposure is something I want to comment about. The main finding we had here was that media exposure was significantly associated with more distress at baseline. And people were tending to overdose themselves some on watching these events. And I have to say, I thought by and large, the media coverage of 9/11 was terrible, that what they kept doing was showing images of the airplanes flying into the building. I've got a strong stomach. I've spent years in emergency rooms. I'm not afraid of the sight of blood. I couldn't watch it. I got to where I just looked away or turned off the television. And people who didn't, I think, were actually doing themselves harm in two ways. Number one, they kept re-traumatizing themselves by being exposed. But number two, there was no useful information attached to these images. And that's the problem, particularly with broadcast television, is that it's all images, you know, either of traumatic events like this or of brain-dead commentators interviewing one another and saying what they think about it, which does you no good at all. If you think about trauma, the essence of trauma is helplessness. It's not fear, it isn't pain. It's the fact that for a period of time, something is happening to your body that you don't control. And the same thing, you had that same sense of helplessness, of course, watching the planes fly into the buildings. Now, to some extent, that goes with the territory. That's part of what it was. But it was the combination of the repetitious visual images and the absence of anything you could do to respond to what was happening, to help people, to do something, that I think made it particularly toxic. You may have noticed that after about 2 days, finally, the network stopped broadcasting those images. And the main reason was that a group of child psychiatrists got to them and said, you know, every time a kid sees that, they think it's happening all over again. They don't understand that this is from 2 days ago or 3 days ago. And that finally convinced the media to stop replaying the images. Now, I'm not recommending that we censor images. I'm saying that we try and have a better mix of the very compelling imagery with useful information about what's going on and what you can do about it. For example, and I'll return to this a bit later, there were people who would get in trucks in Atlanta and drive to New York to try and help, you know, deal with the what remained of the World Trade Center place. There were lots of people who wanted to help and had nowhere to go to figure out what to do. There was a lot of wasted human and emotional energy that could have been mobilized and organized if we had web systems that were designed to handle it. The web can handle it. There's no question. We just were not organized to do it. This is the Pentagon, and one thing about there were a couple of lessons from what happened at the Pentagon. Pentagon's the biggest office building in the world. About 239 people were killed at the Pentagon. That's tragic, but nothing like the thousands who were killed at the World Trade Center. And one reason was that the plane approached it initially from an angle that was too high to hit the first wall it was flying at. This was the only fully steel-reinforced wall of the five in the Pentagon for some reason. There was actually a man standing up here who saw the plane hit the building below him and who lived to tell about it. The building was so strong that there was comparatively little damage. The other thing is that the Army did this right. They had a full general in charge of the search and rescue operation. They had all the families come in and stay in a hotel near the Pentagon. And they had two briefings a day. And this is like the counterbalance to the what I just told you about what the media do. So he would tell the families in the morning what they knew, looking for bodies, looking for people still alive. And he would take questions. And he said, by 1600 this afternoon, I will have the answers for you. And he was a general. He could get the answers. And he did. So they were in charge. They took care of the people there. They made sure they got every bit of information it was possible to get. And they also insisted that the caretakers, physicians, psychologists, social workers who were helping, could work 12-hour shifts and no more. And they said, you're going to go back wherever you are, you're going to get a night's sleep, and you're going to start again, so that you didn't have the kind of caregiver burnout that would tend to happen. So they managed the stress very well. Social networks are very important, and that's something where the Internet also provides tremendous opportunities. There is a measure called social constraints. It's a scale that Stephen Lepore and his colleagues have developed. And what it is a measure of living in the kind of social network in which you are actively discouraged from talking about what's bothering you. And they found, and in that measure, you see here, it was a very strong predictor of more distress, both at baseline and independent of that relationship, at follow-up. So people who had social networks where you just didn't talk about what was bugging you were doing a lot worse than people who lived in social networks where they could talk. And there are tremendous opportunities, both personally but also on the Internet, to stimulate interaction and discussion, and these kind of data would suggest that that would be very helpful to people. And this is, you know, now 1991, a lot of the social networking sites, none of them really existed back then, so that's one opportunity now that simply did not exist then. And this is a picture of New Yorkers showing their distress and being uncharacteristically friendly and supportive to one another, and I can say that as a former New Yorker. In fact, I remember visiting in November, and a cab driver said to me, you know, he said, I feel so much better now. People are honking horns at one another again. You know, people were so nice for 2 months, I just couldn't stand it. You know, New Yorkers are finally getting back to themselves again. Another of the lessons is emotional control. People have strong emotions at the time of trauma. And emotion is a normal adaptive reaction to a difficult situation. We process vast amounts of information, and our emotion system is designed to tell us what's important to pay attention to and what isn't. And yet there's tremendous social pressure often to act as though things aren't bothering you when they are. And it doesn't work. It's a bad strategy at times of stress. And here you see that people who tried to suppress their emotion on a scale called the Courtauld Emotional Control Scale were more distressed and felt less well-being at baseline. It didn't predict long-term outcome, but it was strongly associated with poor outcome at the time, despite the tendency to underreport emotion. So it's a pretty robust effect. You can easily miss how emotionally aroused people are. I'm sure by now you've guessed what these people are doing. They're exiting the World Trade Center shortly before it collapsed. And yet, this is a highly stressful situation, and yet if you didn't know what was going on, the only person who really looks sort of distressed is this lady up here. The rest of them don't. So it is easy for first responders, for families, for others to underestimate the degree of distress that people are going through at times of stress. Denial, substance use, obviously, is not a good strategy, and it was associated with more distress at baseline. But this whopping one here is really interesting. It was a measure of self-blame from Carver's COPE. And it suggested that people who tended to blame themselves for this, you know, how do you, I wish our government blamed itself a little bit more. They had plenty of warning that something bad was going to happen that they completely ignored. And I must say that when Condi Rice left Stanford, she was the provost to become National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State, I used to joke with my friends that it was good for Stanford and bad for the world. And I didn't know how right I was. But we're back to the world being okay and bad for Stanford. She's back. But, she doesn't blame herself for what happened at all. But people tended to. They tend to feel they didn't react properly, that somehow they should have known that bad things were going to happen. They should have been more prepared. And that was very strongly associated with distress at baseline and at six-month follow-up, very strongly. Now, if you think about this, you'll often see this in rape victims, for example, that they will blame themselves for not having known they shouldn't have gone to walk to the drugstore at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, that some assailant would be hiding out for them. It is very common for people to blame themselves for events over which they have no control because people would rather feel guilty than helpless. They'd rather have a fantasy that they were in control of events they really did not control. And from my point of view as a clinician, that is a very strong part of the underlying problems in people who develop post-traumatic stress disorder, that they try desperately psychologically to imagine a scenario in which they controlled events that they really did not control. Emotional support was strongly associated with less distress at follow-up and with more well-being at baseline. So emotional support makes a big difference. Now, one other thing, there's a term that trauma and stress researchers use called speechless horror, and you can see it here, that people often don't know what to say. They don't have words. And there was a study, a PET scanning study of Vietnam vets with PTSD that Scott Rausch and Roger Pittman did, in which they found three parts of the brain activated in people with PTSD. The amygdala, which is a fear, stimulus. The hippocampus, memories, makes sense. The occipital cortex, a lot of visual imagery about trauma, as you could see these people registering. But there was one area of the brain that was underactivated, hypoactivated, and that was Broca's area. It's the one of the two speech centers in the temporal lobe. So they didn't know how to describe what was going on. And I think a lot of what happens in exposure-based and other kinds of psychotherapies is you help give people words for their experiences and then allow them to more actively manipulate those experiences. If one way to think about the brain, and this is pretty simplistic, but it's actually sort of true, is that the front part of the brain is the effector part. It's the part that we use to enact strategies on the world. So you have the frontal lobes where you think about things, you have the motor cortex, you have the speech center where you talk about and engage people and control what's going on in the world like I'm trying to do now. And then the back of the brain is sensory processing. So you take in input, auditory, visual, kinesthetic input. And in a sense, what happens in trauma is that you're thrown back into just reacting to what the world is imposing upon you, not doing anything. And you're inhibiting parts of the brain, like Broca's area, that help you act on the world. And what you do in psychotherapies for trauma is help people become realistically re-engaged in feeling active and in control of those aspects of the traumatic experience they can control. So I think that's a lot of what goes on in good psychotherapy for trauma, is reversing that. Part of it in doing it is being more flexible in your worldview. We found in particular that people who insisted that the world had to go back to the way it was, that did not want 9/11 to influence their feelings about the world, were more distressed both at baseline and follow-up and had less well-being. So cognitive rigidity was associated with bad outcome in dealing with 9/11. I was taking a trip across the Atlantic, and there was this nice lady sitting next to me kind of sneaking peeks at my laptop while I was trying to get a lecture ready. And normally when people ask me what I do on trips, I say I study schizophrenia to get them to just leave me alone. But she obviously knew what I was studying, and she said, look, and we got into actually a very interesting discussion. She said, I worked at 350 Broadway. I lost more than half the people in my firm who were across the street in the World Trade Center. My life changed. time became my friend. She was one of these workaholic 60, 80-hour weeks. I gave up a full-time job, lost 50 pounds, spent more time with my children and parents, and I'm now engaged. I realized that my career wasn't everything. And so people who used it as an occasion to reconsider their life priorities, some of them made major life changes, but they tended in our study to do better than those who wanted things to just go back to the way they were. So what we found is that we could account for about half the variance 6 months later in distress and well-being on the basis of cognitive and emotional changes. So people who were more open to the expression of emotion, who could engage in more interaction with their social networks, who titrated the amount of media they exposed themselves to, who were open to changing their view of the world and not rigidly fixed on things the way they were people who were doing better at 6 months than those who did not. So a lot of the variance in distress and well-being 6 months later could be accounted for by coping strategies and social support at the time of 9/11. We think, therefore, that there was a kind of vicious circle of poor adjustment that involved self-blame, looking backwards, social constraint, lack of emotional support, denial, disengagement, emotional suppression, and substance abuse. And you can see how each of these types of maladaptive response could trigger others, that doing this would tend to add to social constraints and result in less emotional and social support, looking backward rather than forward. So we think there are ways to think about how you could help people out of this vicious cycle so that they don't get stuck in it after a traumatic event like 9/11. Oscar Wilde said, human beings have been endowed with imagination as a compensation for what they are not and with a sense of humor as consolation for what they are. I want to share with you a few comments. We got a lot of email as well from people who participated in the study. And we had some surprising results because we conceived of this not as an intervention, but as just data gathering, which is what I presented to you. However, many people took it as an intervention. And, you know, as an experienced psychotherapist, I think I know when I'm doing psychotherapy and when I'm not, but it turned out I was wrong, that many people actually experienced this as a therapeutic opportunity. And there were three categories. They experienced it as talking to a virtual ear, as an opportunity for active coping, and as an opportunity for cognitive restructuring and social comparison. So here are some of the comments. This exercise helped me a lot. I did shed a tear and it felt good. Thank you for caring. And I think one of the lessons is that it was not a dangerous or a bad thing to give people an opportunity to revisit in this controlled setting their memories of 9/11. You know, there are some people that think, don't bring it up, don't talk about it, let them forget about it. Well, they don't forget about it. So providing an opportunity where they could address their own reactions to it. And here she's saying in one sentence, I shed a tear and it felt good. We tend to think of affect as being sort of bipolar, you know, that you're either high or you're low. In fact, even if you're bipolar, you're also depressed just below the surface at the same time. You can co-activate sadness and happiness. And in fact, what people do when they try to suppress their sadness, they tend to suppress all affective expression. So they're less happy as well. So the idea of being shedding a tear and feeling good makes a lot of sense to me. In fact, a lot of depressed people I see say, I just wish I could have a good cry and get it over with. Experiencing the emotion can be very helpful. I would like to thank you for allowing me to participate in your six-month follow-up survey. It was very cathartic for me. I tend to keep things bottled up inside, so this was a great opportunity to explore how I felt about things. It made me think, and I appreciate that. Just participating helps process the horrors, alleviates the pain and terror for a few moments. Now, alleviates the pain and terror. I'm asking them to think about the pain and terror, and she experienced it as alleviating it. As I realized the six-month marker was approaching, I found myself looking forward to hearing from your study. I really appreciate having this opportunity to set aside time and reflect on the many questions you pose. I feel it's an important part of the healing process for me, and I'm sure many, many others as well. Taking the survey also helped me sort out some of my feelings and reactions. I haven't done much about it, but it does help to understand some of my thoughts and behaviors in reaction to September 11th and the subsequent biochemical attacks. Now, it also helped them they were doing something active to cope with their emotional response. They felt that we were listening, even though it was a website that was listening to them. They also restructured their view of their own experience. I cannot believe how timely your email is concerning the 9/11 follow-up. I look forward to participating. I have been so ultra aware of my own mortality these last months. I've also noticed how tight I am wound emotionally. So your survey comes in a very appropriate time when I feel like talking about it. television programs ever bring to mind some of the events of that horrible day, I look at some of these images on TV and it seems as if I'm seeing them for the first time. Funny how one can stand outside of themselves and see a better view. So even, again, re-exposing themselves in this structured way helped to see it from a different point of view. And another one wrote, I realized while taking the six-month follow-up how much I'd improved since the 9/11 attacks. Now, I never thought of a Likert scale as a therapeutic tool, but I'm here to tell you that there were people who would say, you know what, you have 0 to 6 for anxiety. You know, I'm only a 2 now, and I was a 4 the last time I answered. I must be getting better. Or they would say, you have a range of 0 to 6. You know, I'm only a 3. There must be people who are a 6. So I must be doing a lot better than other people out there. So they would use the questions as information and as a tool for social comparison. And they found it helpful in doing that. We have some other data that was actually published in the Canadian Psychiatric Association Bulletin in 2002. And as I say, there are other reports on this coming out now. I don't know who wrote God on the back of that truck. This was just on the day that 9/11 happened. The three categories of cards are congratulations on the left, get well on the right, and in the middle, good luck with the American healthcare system. We have a lot to learn from Canadians. Yeah. So there were a lot of epi findings. I won't take a lot of time going through these, but there were a number of studies, and you'll hear tomorrow morning from Dr. Schlanger about some of his studies on PTSD, but the rates were substantially elevated of PTSD. Although PTSD tends to be a very chronic illness, the good news is that the rates went back to baseline after about 6 months. So there was a big burst of PTSD-like symptoms, but they seemed to resolve fairly quickly. Depression was high, and by the way, one of the sad but interesting things is in New Orleans, it's sort of the reverse. The rates of PTSD after the hurricane are not very high. The rates of depression are very high, and that's because people realize how little the government has or will do to help them recover their city after the disorder, after the hurricane. Higher symptoms were related to proximity to the attacks, being female, marital separation, media exposure, as I mentioned, and poor coping strategies, like this one here. The 7.5%, this is Sandy Galea's study, had PTSD, 10% with consistent with depression, and it was 20% rates of PTSD below Canal Street, so close to the World Trade Center. So 1 out of 5 people at the time, it's very high. There was a study using random digit dialing, and this looked at stress symptoms. People at least 90% said they had stress symptoms to some degree, and their natural coping strategies were talking to others, almost everybody, religion, group activities, and donations. So forming social relationships and doing something to help were what everybody wanted to do. And that's where I think the Internet provides a tremendous opportunity. We've done some studying of support groups on the Internet. Now, some other parts of my work involve working with breast cancer patients who are chronically rather than acutely stressed. I was kind of skeptical, being a sort of, you know, face-to-face, in-person group therapy kind of guy. But I was surprised to find in this study that we got substantial reductions in depression. This wasn't a randomized trial, but pre-post differences were pretty significant on the CESD with just 16 synchronous online support groups for women with breast cancer. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity for synchronous and asynchronous groups. And this was done before bandwidth was very wide, and so people were actually typing responses. It was very clunky compared, and it was definitely 2D and not 3D like what you saw last night. So I think there's opportunities for making it much easier to interact and much more vivid. And there's reason to think that these kinds of online support group programs can work extremely well also. So in summary, stressors are best handled with the acronym FACES. Face rather than flee, alter your worldview, cope actively, find some way to cope actively with the trauma, express emotion, and enhance social support. I want to mention, consistent with that, a report that the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences released in 2007. I was on the committee reviewing the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are a couple of take-home points that I think suggest what we perhaps can do. using the internet to help people who have either full syndrome PTSD or some symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the surprise findings, interestingly, was that there was not sufficient evidence to determine that pharmacology works. There were evidence in some studies, but not others, that serotonin reuptake inhibitors seem to help. The evidence on benzodiazepines is, to the extent that there's evidence, it shows that they do not help, and what they tend to do is get people habituated to them. They're widely used, they're not effective. And with a few minor examples of drugs like prazosin for nightmares, there was really no clear evidence that there is an effective psychopharmacology for PTSD. So the idea that just reaching for the prescription pad is going to solve these problems is not supported by the evidence at this time. The strongest evidence was for exposure-based therapies. There are obviously, and I think one of the points we made in the report is that it is, you know, there are blurry lines among the different types of psychotherapy. So in exposure-based therapies, where you have people bring on specific recollections of the trauma and ask them how they think and feel about these traumatic experiences, involve also some cognitive restructuring, some thinking about how they might handle stress in the future, some relationship issues, that is, they see that they can have these feelings and not be immediately rejected by the therapist. But the exposure-based therapies tend to focus on the remembering and reliving these traumatic events. The fact that exposure-based therapies have the strongest evidence makes it, I think, crystal clear that revisiting memories of trauma is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. It's something people need to do. If they could have put it aside, they would have. And so effective psychotherapies have to help people deal with it, along the lines of the way you saw people interpreting the questionnaires that we gave them on the website. So I think finding ways for people to revisit their traumatic memories, process them, come to some different relationship to their memories, enhance their social support, can be potential therapeutic benefit to people in the acute aftermath of a major traumatic event. In particular, the report recommended research on early interventions and time since exposure and duration of diagnosis as treatment effectiveness variables. And again, that's where the internet offers tremendous opportunities to get there fast. Before you can deploy a whole array of psychotherapists, you can have a website up online that can help people begin, at least those people who can handle it, to begin to address their reactions to the trauma. So I think in terms of, there was an interesting discussion about one of the differences between 9/11 and Katrina, is that with 9/11 and in D.C., people stayed where they were, whereas the majority of people in New Orleans are in diaspora. They had to move all over the country. Well, the internet can follow them. And so there are opportunities to use the internet to help people wherever they are, as long as they can get online. And then there are interesting questions on the optimal duration of treatment and duration of follow-up. And again, the internet provides tremendous opportunities for contacting people and recontacting them to see how they're doing. So the kinds of opportunities I think the internet provides us are information provision to people that is rapid, specific, can be linked to action. You may remember that on television there would be these very sad images of a few family members holding a picture of their loved one who had been in the World Trade Center saying, has anybody seen this person? But it was very inefficient. I thought it was mostly exploitation of the family members, frankly. It didn't lead to finding anybody. But there would be ways on the internet to do that now, for families to post missing people who are missing and say, here, if you have any information about this person, please let us know. Tremendous opportunities for that rapid information provision that is tremendously valuable to people, linking people who have abilities to opportunities to help. And that's also something where there's a period in the immediate aftermath of a trauma, major trauma, where there's a tremendous community response and cohesion. It usually lasts for 2 to 4 weeks. Then there's a period, it's a pretty bad period afterwards, when everybody is still distressed and displaced and has lots of problems, but nobody's talking about it anymore. So people tend to get very fussy and uncomfortable with one another, and you have a sort of down period about a month to 2 months after a major trauma, and then things sort of gradually re-equilibrate. You want to use that golden period of 2 to 4 weeks when people are open and willing and want to help. It's good for their mental health, it's good for the community, but we've tended to have very poor ways to mobilize and employ it, and I think the internet is a tremendous opportunity for that. It provides opportunities for reflection about people's personal experience, opportunity for mutual support on social networking sites. You've heard some about that at this meeting, and we'll hear more. specific supportive and group intervention kinds of programs, synchronous and asynchronous. I think there's a tremendous opportunity for doing that on the Internet much more than we have been. So the Internet is both vast and fast, and I think it can provide us with opportunities if we plan in advance for how to mobilize it when community traumas happen. This image, I think, is particularly important because it illustrates two kinds of affect here. It illustrates, on the one hand, their fear and sadness about what they're witnessing, but they're also very close. I don't even know if these two women knew each other before the attack, but what I do know is they were very close at that moment. And in working for decades with people who are seriously distressed and traumatized, I can tell you that isolation amplifies distress, and feeling close to other people really does begin to modulate it. You feel terrible, but you feel accepted and close. And that's what a lot of what happens in various psychotherapies for trauma. It's something that the Internet can help mediate as well. It's not the same as a hug like this, but you can provide a lot of emotional support for people who are going through the same kind of problem together. Shakespeare put it very well, of course. He said, "When we are better, see bearing our woes, we scarcely think our miseries our foes. The mind much sufferance doth o'erskip when grief hath mates and bearing fellowship." This is our Center on Stress and Health. Lisa Butler, Canadian, right here, is now a professor at the University of Buffalo, has a new trauma research center not too far from here, and she's a professor there helping to run that program, and she was a key person in making the 9/11 Internet study work. Janine Giese-Davis is now at the University of Calgary. For a while, my lab had a positive brain drain. I had all these bright Canadians working for me, and now Canada is raiding my laboratory, and they've decided to come north. And I can tell you that if Sarah Palin were vice president, I'd be moving north too, but it didn't. So finally, he's saying, my feeling is that while we should have the deepest respect for reality, we should not let it control our lives. Thank you for your attention. So I think we have time for questions or comments. Yes, sir. There we go. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hello.
There we go.
What I'd like to ask you about is my memory of a series of articles that dealt with this whole issue of debriefing, acute debriefing,
yeah.
Which basically said, no, not a good idea.
Yeah.
And now what you're saying is exposing or having the person come to terms, face, expose themselves to the memory of the event acutely is a good idea. So are you right or are they right?
We're both right. This is I should have known this question was coming. It's a very good question. There was an article, I think, in the British Medical Journal about critical incident stress debriefing, which is a particular brand of acute debriefing after trauma, and it was a randomized trial on motor vehicle accident victims, and they found that the people who got the CISD actually were worse off at follow-up than those who didn't. The problem there is that the particular brand of so-called therapy, I think, is really bad. That what I call it drive-by psychotherapy. That what they do is they roll in, they convince companies that they have to hire them after a shooting at a factory or something, that if they don't do it, the mental health of the company will go to hell and they have to do it. So they've made a lot of money on this. They go in, they go around the room, so they don't use interactive group process at all. They sit people down, what happened, how'd you feel about it, what happened, how'd you feel about it. So in this sort of very ritualistic way, they have people talk about it, sort of expose themselves but not really do anything to resolve how they're feeling. There's no follow-up, there's no follow-up group, so you're not building relationships. And the other thing that's dangerous in companies is these people aren't strangers who meet once a week in a group. They work with one another. So, you know, some boss has started to cry, and has he got authority with the people the next day back in the office? It's a very complex situation. The other thing they do in CISD that I think is just terrible is they say, okay, here's how you feel now. Here's how you're going to feel 2 months from now. You're going to have nightmares and flashbacks and startle reactions. Now, the last thing I need to hear after somebody's been shot in front of me or, you know, my family's been in an accident is how bad I'm going to feel 2 months from now. Thanks very much, but no thanks. So I think the problem with CISD is that particular brand of intervention. And my clinical experience and the data from this study indicate, I mean, here these people are saying, I felt better, and I wasn't even trying to do therapy, but I'm asking them right afterwards to confront their feelings about it. And if you look at the overwhelming literature on the psychotherapy of PTSD, and Barbara Rothbaum is here, one of the pioneers in that, it's by exposing people to it. It's not by avoiding it. Denial and avoidance don't work.
It's really a question of context and to what degree there's some individual connection, because I remember getting a desperate call asking members of my department, the U of T, to come down to New York to participate in these debriefings. This was, of course, by a company that, international EAP company that had a massive contract with some of the large financial houses. And they just wanted to roll a bus down of debriefers and do this thing. And, you know, none of us went. But it really begs the questions of what can you do on a mass level? What, you know, and maybe this is somewhat of an answer.
Yeah, well, I think there are good things that you can do. And I'll tell you one thing that's pretty interesting, and that is that the New York Fire Department and the Police Department had different strategies about that. So the New York Fire Department insisted on a debriefing visit with a psychologist, not immediately, but within a year. They had to go. So there was no stigma. You just had to do it. The police department did not, and so very few police did. There were more suicides in the year after 9/11 in the police department than in the fire department, even though the police were far less harmed than the fire. The fire department had huge losses. A lot of people died in the buildings as they collapsed. The police lost very few people. But the psychological outcome as measured by the suicide rate was worse among the police. So my reading of it is that CISD is one thing, but the idea that there are effective ways to help people deal, I think there's sort of a golden period. Sandy McFarland has done very good research on this in Australia, of between 2 days and 2 weeks after a severe trauma, when people either come to terms with it or they don't. So they either do the kind of cognitive emotional processing they need to do, or they're going to be in trouble for a long time. And I think there is an opportunity to help people there if you do it right. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, in the back there.
Debrief a good debriefing someone before they would go to sleep or let the sleep sink in the memory?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think it's been studied. The closest that people have come to looking at that is there have been trials of two kinds of medication on the day of trauma. And one is propranolol, a beta adrenergic blocker. And the idea was that you would sort of block the consolidation of association between trauma and physiological arousal. The results of the trials have frankly been somewhat disappointing. So there has been a little bit of effect on psychological outcome, not much on physiological outcome. It doesn't really work that well as a conditioner. The other thing, actually, oddly enough, is giving cortisol. In Europe, they tend to do that now. They actually give elevated, so they elevate your glucocorticoid level on the day of trauma. And there are some reports, there was a paper at the last ISTSS from Israel suggesting that that may actually, you know, if you mobilize glucose when you're stressed, you feel better able to respond to it, that might help. In terms of doing the debriefing, you know, obviously access is one issue. But I frankly think if people want to, I wouldn't coerce people, but I would offer them an opportunity. And if they want to, because part of what you want to do is widen the range of associations to the trauma. And the immediate message of the trauma is, you know, you could have been dead, horrible things happened. And that's the reality that you would go to sleep with. But if you can help people see at the time of the trauma that it was terribly distressing, but look, you're alive, maybe you engaged in some strategy that actually changed the odds and protected yourself or helped someone else. If you can widen the range of associations to the traumatic input right away, I think you're giving the person a better chance.
Thank you.
There's a... Okay.